Cachimbonas, welcome to season 6 of Radio Cachimbona. Radio Cachimbona is an abolitionist podcast that audio archives state repression and fierce migrant resistance in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and beyond, and breaks down case law and politics from a leftist perspective. As the daughter of Salvadoran immigrants, Yvette prioritizes uplifting the voices and histories of Central Americans. On this episode, I was very honored to have Thelma Dietrich Rivera, who is a first-generation Nicaraguan and scholar mother of two beautiful Nicaraguan Belizean young women. She is currently a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology at UC Riverside. And we discussed a recent article that she wrote where she was describing the poetic practices of exiled Nicaraguans living in Costa Rica. We got into so much in the interview, so much Nicaraguan political history that I think was long overdue on the podcast. We talked about the 2018 brutalization and murders of over 300 protesting Nicaraguans and the mass exile that it caused, and the broader political historical context in which that occurred, the formation of the FSLN, the ascendancy of Daniel Ortega and his wife Rosario Murillo to the presidency, and the ensuing authoritarian turn that his government took. It was a super rich conversation, and I'm super excited for you guys to hear it. I met Thelma at the Central American Futurities Conference in Dartmouth, and it was such a pleasure to be on the Alternative Knowledges and Methods panel with her and with all my other co-panelists. I think that you all are really going to enjoy this episode and this conversation. If you want to support the podcast, the best way to do so is by joining the online Patreon community. Patreon is a subscription service, and through subscribing every month, you will get access to the Lit Review, which is a book club for Cachimbonas. It's a Patreon exclusive segment where I break down timely texts with other women of color. I just want to take this second to implore you to support the podcast if you are monetarily able to do so. I understand that this economy is so chaotic and it's difficult for many at the moment, but if you can spare as little as $3 a month, that's less than a cup of coffee, then you are actually allowing me to continue podcasting. This is a 100% listener-supported podcast. I don't do ad space, and it's really because I believe in the beauty and truly special aspect of podcasting. This podcast is that when it is ad-free, when there is no outside corporate intervention, it really is just a conversation between me as y'all's friend and you, the listener. And I know that trusted people, trusted media folks, trusted podcasters, just trusted voices in general are few and far between these days because of the limitations of corporate media and the public becoming more and more aware of that. And at the same time, rampant misinformation and disinformation. Right now really is the time to actually invest, you personally invest in the voices that you want to hear more from, because the truth is that unless the Patreon community grows, I won't be able to continue podcasting. It's already a struggle to try and regularly get these episodes out while also handling all of my scholarship and writing and teaching and the organizing work that I do. And so this is something that I can only continue doing if there's patron support. So I implore you all to please give if you can. I wanted to thank the newest Patreon member, Langston Hamilton, for joining. You all are critical in keeping this going. This episode would not have happened without Langston Hamilton and the other Patreons. So thank you so much. If you want to support the podcast but can't do so monetarily, you can leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps us get new listeners, helps maintain the visibility of the podcast, and helps new people find us. So please do that if you can, and follow at Radio Cachimbona on Instagram, X, and Facebook to continue the conversation there. Oh, I forgot to mention, wow, incredibly important after I just gave you that emotional plea, I forgot to let you know how to join the Patreon, which is, it's going to be in a link in the episode show notes, or it's always in the link in my bio on Instagram. You can also Google patreon.com/Radio Cachimbona and you will find it there. Thanks to Grant Bloom for the intro and the audio editing. As always, I hope that you all enjoy this episode. Bye. Hello, Cachimbonas. Today, I am very honored to have Thelma Dietrich Rivera, who is a first-generation Nicaraguan and scholar mother of two beautiful Nicaraguan Belizean young women. She is currently a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology at UC Riverside. She received her BA in Sociology and Anthropology and a master's in Latin American and Iberian Studies from UC Santa Barbara. Thelma is a UC President's Pre-Professoriate Fellow, completing her dissertation titled Displaced Diasporas, Narratives of Displacement, Migration, and Survival Across Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and the U.S. Thelma's commitment to archiving transnational resistance stems from valuing gender feminist perspectives on lived experiences, history, and knowledge production. By examining histories and narratives through an interdisciplinary and intercultural lens, she attempts to identify the ethical implications of radical consciousness and embodied practices that resist and challenge systemic violence, structural systems, and legacies of oppression. Thelma's community-engaged oral history research contributes to a social justice framework, humanizing the silenced, the exiled, and the asylum seekers' experience. Thelma will begin at UCI in the fall as a UC President's postdoctoral fellow advancing research on Central American migrant experiences in the U.S. Thelma, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Eva. It's an honor.
So, and I will just mention that we met actually at the Dartmouth Central American Futurities Conference. We were both on the Alternative Knowledges and Methods panel. And I was so thrilled to learn about your work and was really excited when you accepted my invitation to come onto the podcast. So super excited that we get to continue that conversation here.
Go ahead. I was just going to say it was such a beautiful experience. One, to be on the same panel as you and the rest of the participants, but just the space of having so much commonality. Like, all of our work was rooted in Central American art, life experience. Everything that was Central America was represented that day, and so I still keep living that moment because it was such a beautiful moment. And to know that we're still extending these connections makes me very happy.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, of course. You described the lives of the exiled Nicaraguans living in Costa Rica that you wrote about in the article that we're discussing today as a, quote, on-the-ground practice of existing otherwise. Could you explain what existing otherwise means or looks like in the context that you were writing about?
Yeah, that specific piece right there, existing otherwise, is something that I extend from in relation to Black feminist studies, right? Thinking about Sadia Hartman, thinking about Hortense Spillers, and their work about pushing against, right, this idea of being erased, excluded, in terms of thinking about how violence can do that to a person, right? Erase them. And so the work that I'm focusing on in this specific article is understanding how these group of women and queer identifying folk are essentially pushing against that and creating other ways of belonging, other ways of understanding how to create a life, even when there is violence and erasure and exclusion happening at the same time.
That's super powerful.
Mm
I wanted to sort of situate the history of this before we get more into the poetry event that you write about. Why was it that these Nicaraguan women were exiled in Costa Rica in the first place when you went to interview them and write about this article?
Yeah, so I had a long-standing relationship specifically with a few of them already. During my master's, I had done research specifically focusing on Afro descendant feminist participation in the revolution of the 1970s and 80s in Nicaragua. And I was doing that as a way to kind of push back against this meta narrative that exists in Nicaragua that frames Nicaragua as a very pivotal moment, right? And how feminist participation was at its pinnacle in terms of political participation. So that already was kind of already ingrained in the region. And so when I mention region, I'm talking about the Atlantic coast specifically. And so the majority of these folks that I was in conversation with prior to this event that I'm about to talk about were already had a history. It was part of the culture to activate against political struggles, feminist struggles, gender-based struggles, economic struggles. So here comes April 18th, 2018, and a mass demonstration happens, and it essentially takes the whole nation by storm. This political moment is organized specifically by university students, the community at large, and the elderly. And so what they were struggling against or demonstrating against was that the state, the Nicaraguan government, had created reforms specifically to the Social Security tax, which would increase the taxes that the elderly would pay and the civil servants that work for the government would also pay. And in addition to that, it would also decrease the amount of Social Security that elderly would receive. And so demonstrators came together to protest that. But in addition to that, there was also this climate issue that was happening in the protected regions of Nicaragua, which are essentially in the autonomous regions of the Atlantic coast, where most of the Afro descendants and indigenous communities live. And in the region of that area, there had been a fire that was that had been uncontrolled for over, I believe, 3 weeks, if I remember correctly. And the community, the activists, and even other parts of the country were pushing the government to respond to these fires. And as a Californian, I'm assuming that you're in LA, you know the devastation that fires can do to our communities, right? And so to know that that's happening in a country that doesn't have a lot of resources a fire can devastate a whole community. And that's what was happening weeks and weeks and weeks. Weeks and weeks and weeks. Sorry, I'm losing my track of mind here. Can we pause?
Yeah.
Okay, let me go back. Okay, we're back. So in the Indio Maíz Reserve, this fire was happening for weeks, and the government didn't take any action. And if it did take action, it was very, very slow. So you have this reserve burning. And then you have these reforms that the government is trying to implement. And that essentially created the moment that was April 18th of 2018. And so these demonstrations took off, and you saw thousands and thousands and thousands of people taking to the streets that day. But what was more alarming was the reaction that the government took, right? And this is a government that's been praised, right, for its social movements, for its push to have, you know, students, university students participate politically. And here they are, right, taking up their call to politically organize around things that they find important and urgent. And the state reacts by total impunity. And that day ended with a lot of civil unrest. Up to 300 murders. I'm going to call them murders, but some folks will just call them deaths, right? Many people were arrested that day, including the elderly. And so the reaction that the state had led to one that was trying to diffuse the civil unrest, but then that diffusion ended into repression. And that repression then led into political persecution, intimidation, surveillance. And this is the, I guess you could call the political violent cocktail that leads many of these interlocutors in this chapter to take up migration, right? To seek out exile against being politically persecuted by the government. And many of them had already been receiving direct threats by the government, by the national police, because of the fact that they did show up and they participated on April 18th, and they continued to participate and critique against the government. And so what the government essentially tried to do to dissuade people to politically push against and politically critique the government was to essentially create like a narrative, a rhetoric against their opponents, right? Creating an anti-terrorist narrative, an anti-state narrative that essentially criminalized anyone that spoke up against the government or tried to organize against the government. And again, that essentially created an umbrella over anyone that was either an activist, a student, or even just an everyday citizen. So this narrative, this rhetoric that was created by the government, essentially produced like an overarching strategy of repression, and this is essentially what creates, right, this moment for these exiled community of Nicaraguans in Costa Rica to consider: do I stay and fight against this political repression, or do I find ways to leave the country, find, an alternate existence elsewhere, but still trying to maintain my activism from afar? So that's essentially what gets us right to San Jose, Costa Rica, in which I talk about in this specific article.
There's so much in what you just said that I want to ask follow-up questions about, But the first thing that I wanted to clarify was that that this moment is also indicative of the turn that the Sandinista presidency has taken. Could you explain the first part of your research and
sure,
like what role they played in the Sandinista movement at that time?
Yeah. In my master's thesis, I write about the memories, right, of Afro descendants participating in the political revolution. And I did that primarily because I already had a relationship with them, and hearing them about what they did and all these great things that they did, that the revolution allowed them to do as women who are also Black, right? Which is a part of history that isn't necessarily seen and is also subsumed over the mestiza experience. Not to say that the mestiza experience isn't important, but in addition to the mestiza experience, there were also many, many stories, many, many experiences coming from the Atlantic coast. And so what did this participation look like? For the majority of the women that I interviewed back in 2016, and this is prior, right, to 2018's political uprising, they participated by doing the reading brigades, right? Going out to different communities and teaching people how to read, how to write, organizing politically in their communities by setting up surveillance groups, right, that are now known as CPCs, right, citizens councils, is what they essentially are called. Other things that they also did was organizing around getting people to sign up and be members of the political party. And also bridging, right, political participation, political consciousness with gender consciousness. So a lot of the teachings that they would do at a community level were to bridge these two things together. How do we understand, or actually three things together, right? Their understanding as Afro-descendant women and their political participation, along with how their gender is impacted, right? Or even how their gender allows them or is impacted by this political moment, right? So their participation it was almost three-pronged. And so kind of jumping to modern day, I don't necessarily talk about this in my article, but I do in my dissertation, is that I do a revisitation of some of these women that I interviewed prior. And this political moment of April 18th, it's almost like it's a paradoxical one where essentially they were at the front lines of the political movement in the 1970s and 80s. Some of them actually even were sent by the government to go study in places like Russia, the Ukraine, right, to receive, you know, their undergrad and their master's paid by these countries that were associated with Nicaragua at that time. And now you have them kind of reflecting, right, 40 plus years later and saying, I cannot believe there were that this same government that I politically participated with in my youth is almost turning its back against me and our political party. And so it's almost like a moment of shock, and it's a moment of essentially like a sense of betrayal of how we got from these revolutionary concepts, these revolutionary on the ground realities that really changed lives for folks, to now seeing the onslaught of political violence just taking over the country. And so those are kind of the two things that I've been looking at too, is how this this idea of revolution that the Nicaraguan government has tried to keep as a memory has shifted in so many people's lives. Like the sense of understanding and what, and the, also the relationship that people have had to the political party has essentially shifted in many ways.
Yeah. And I was really struck by, in your article, you note that the demands made by a large segment of the Nicaraguan public are no longer draped under a Sandinista red and black flag, but instead under the national blue and white flag, representing the lives lost that they're fighting for justice for. Do you think that that's like a reflection of the left no longer supporting the Sandinista government?
Yeah, I was actually doing some reading, and I came across this article that actually I shared it with one of our presenters, Jonathan, where they essentially quote, right, the leftist-leaning Central American Alliance of Researchers. And they're discussing what's happening in Nicaragua right now, or what was happening in 2018, and saying, you know, it's hard for us Central Americanists who are left-leaning to forget that these two people are icons of the revolution, right? And how do you contend with the fact that now it's almost like they've done a 360 where they're acting very much like the dictator that they fought against to essentially push out? And the blue and white flag is a symbolic to that break between ideology and actual on the ground realities, right? Where the realities of people are that they want to have a humane form of life. They want to be able to have their political and civil freedoms and not turn back to an oppressive society, right? And the blue and white flag symbolizes that and takes it on as almost like a cape of something that is totally against, right, this political repressive moment.
And when you mentioned the two people that are icons, you're talking about Daniel Ortega and his wife, Rosario Murillo.
Correct. Yes.
How do you explain their story? Is it just the standard power corrupts?
You know, I'm going to oust myself here. Like, prior to 2018, I was enamored by the revolution. And I still am to some extent. I still am. But enamored with these two folks, not at all. Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo are an interesting couple. They both have their strengths, right, in what they do. But right now, I wrote a whole chapter on Rosario Murillo's specifically the narrative of who she is, who she was, and also understanding how her speech is, because again, she's a poet, right? So this is why, you know, poetry is so important to my dissertation and to the women and the queer individuals in these chapters, because poetry is so much part of our culture. And it is a way to express, right? It is a way to understand the inner workings of our being as an emotive being, right? And to know that Rosario Murillo was an accomplished poet, and uses those, I argue that she uses, right, that knowledge of poetry to produce this new persona, this orator, right? This public orator that essentially creates this rhetoric through a very interesting way. Her rhetoric is embedded in, one, chastising any opposition, chastising imperialism, but she does it in a very poetic way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like she's talking to you. Sometimes she takes a motherly approach. Sometimes she takes a compañera approach, which she tends to call her listeners compañeros, compañeras, mm-hmm. right? But there's other times where she's just going in and it's just like spewing hatred, right? She's been known, she's been cited multiple times with the words that she uses, vampiros, minúsculos, insectos, you know, she uses these very hard, harsh words to dehumanize her opponents. And her opponents are essentially anyone who participated in the April 18th uprising. And that includes, you know, even our Miss Universe, right? Shanice Palacios. Shanice Palacios, prior to her becoming Miss Universe, had posted a picture of herself at the protest.
Mm.
And then once she won, she had deleted it. But the way that social media and the internet world works,
right?
Rosario Murillo had already seen it.
Mm.
And that's when she just spewed some more hatred in her speeches. So to kind of bring this back, her poetry is very important, and it's important to our culture. And so she uses those strengths that she has built, right, by being a poet. And instead of creating poetry, now she creates these speeches. And these speeches are given every single day at noon.
Hmm.
And they're broadcasted on TV, on the radio, and then on YouTube. So every day she has a speech, and sometimes they begin with giving, you know, very bureaucratic information, talking about this, you know, the state of things right throughout the country. But then she has like a message, and sometimes it's Christian based, sometimes it's based on the politics, or it's based on whatever she wants to talk about, right? But she has the space. And it's sometimes these are 13 minutes long, sometimes these are 45 minutes long, but it's just her talking and talking and talking in a very poetic and very just interesting way of giving a message. But she is the one that I believe has a lot of influence right now. But she cannot have that influence without Daniel Ortega. So it's almost like they work off of each other. And this has made it even more true now that as of January 31st, 2025, Daniel Ortega has essentially written essentially created a new political position, making her co-president, a position that did not exist prior to that. And also a position that she wasn't elected into. None of the positions that she had has she been elected into. So she started right as the first lady. And then she from there, she took over becoming the chief of communications. So she did all the speeches. She did all the political talks. She did all the political meetings. Anything that had to do with public facing communication, she did. From there, then she became vice president, right? Daniel Ortega rewrote the constitution to make her vice president. And now the last iteration of this is where he essentially took over the constitution and essentially made her co-president. So now it just solidifies, right, their power grab over the Nicaraguan government and the nation overall.
Yeah, you called them the Sandinista ruling clique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Did Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo always demonstrate these authoritarian tendencies? Was that an inevitable consequence of the political revolution, or was there a moment in which a shift happened and the devaluing of democratic started?
It's like, we don't want to think that this just like, you know, it just came out of thin air, right? Everything leads, you know, there's always, you know, history has taught us that we need to make sure that we look at our past to know how we get to this juncture, right? And that goes, that is very much true with Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo. Daniel Ortega, although in the 1980s, he was essentially elected to be the president of the revolution. But when the 1990s came and the U.S. Pressured Nicaragua to have open elections, he agreed. And in that instance, he lost to Violeta Chamorro. But that did not mean that he disappeared or that he took it as a full-on loss, right? Thaler and Mosinger, which are scholars, Central American, Nicaraguan scholars, they write about Daniel Ortega's ascension. Mm-hmm. And they talk about it in ways that show Daniel Ortega has never left the political scene. He's been working behind the scenes since 1990 to find allies, right? And allies that exist in, you know, religious sectors, allies that exist in oppositional parties, allies that exist even within his, you know, his own social circles. And in doing so, he's creating strong ties and showing, right, that he has the ability to essentially manipulate spaces, manipulate political parties to his for his own strategy. Mm. And so when he comes to power in 2007, he has already had a long trajectory. What, almost 17 years, right? 1990 to about 2007, about 17 years of him working behind the scenes to get this political strength and political influence to get him elected. But prior to that, right, we don't want to give a sense that like he just won in 2007 because of the fact that he had this revolutionary, he represented this revolutionary memory, which for some he did, mm-hmm. right? But for others, it was a political ploy. He knew how to move his chips. He knew how to move, you know, chess. Forgot the other one. He knows how to move his pieces on the board, right?
Yeah.
And so when he wins in 2007, he is backed by the Catholic Church, right? He's backed by his oppositional political parties to some extent. And of course, and he has, you know, Rosario Murillo there right alongside with him through all of that. And I write about in this other chapter where I'm specifically focused on Rosario Murillo and how essentially, like, what was she doing in that time period, right? How is she also, because she's not just a, you know, a person on the side. Mm-mm. She really comes on to the political stage. And here I'm extending from Cristina Aguadala's work, sociologist at Occidental, who essentially talks about the anti-feminist authoritarian turn that Rosario Murillo takes once Daniel Ortega becomes president in 2007. And 2007 is important to consider as well, because this is when Rosario Murillo essentially inserts herself or is inserted into like the public domain. And it just so happens that Rosario Murillo's daughter comes out with claims that she had been abused by her stepfather, Daniel Ortega. Soy La America is her name. Soy La America is the eldest daughter of Rosario Murillo, who is not the daughter, biological daughter of Daniel Ortega. And here she is coming out saying, that she had been abused by him for many years and that her mother knew. And so Rosario Murillo is put into like a position of like, okay, what do you say as the mother of this person? What do you say? And essentially, what Cristina Vadala shows us is that Rosario Murillo, instead of taking her daughter's position or empathizing with her daughter's experience, essentially turns that and criminalizes her daughter. Criminalizes her daughter and chastises her daughter by saying, almost in a way, why did you bring this up here? Why did you open it up to the public? This is a family matter. And essentially pushes her daughter out of the limelight, if you want to call it that, and essentially rejects her daughter's account of what happened. And from that, then she's showing, right, that she would rather take her husband's side over her daughter's. And this creates a big issue in terms of how do we understand feminism? How do we understand issues of sexualized abuse, specifically when looking at it through the lens of those political leaders that are supposed to lead us? And specifically for women, how are we feeling safe knowing that our own, first lady, is denying these allegations that her daughter's putting forward? And essentially, her daughter is ex exiled to Costa Rica as well and has been living in Costa Rica ever since. And she is quoted in an article that the article's name escapes me, but it references Soy La America's words and saying, she did this to me. I can only imagine what she's going to do to the rest of the nation. And it's chilling because it's what we're seeing currently right now, right? This political repression is inclusive, right, of this anti-feminist flavor that she's taken on. And she showed, it's almost like she showed her hand in back in 2007, and we're coming to realize it now with what's happening in this moment.
So Daniel Ortega framed himself as coming out of the political revolution, but what role did he actually play, if any?
It's interesting. That's always been a great conversation to have around, drinks with folks that know this, right? Because it gets really, really dicey. From my research and from my understanding is that he was one of the nine, right? And he primarily wasn't even in the actual fighting, right? He was actually imprisoned and exiled. And once we got closer to the actual victory, he was essentially elected to become like the face of the movement. And he was a man of a few words, as he still is, right? He's very like matter of fact, man of few words, but for some reason that worked for the nine. The nine leaders of the FSLN movement. And since then, he became the face of the political party. So it's like, it depends on who you ask, but the research and the historical archive shows that, he was one among the nine, but for the majority, he was essentially exiled for like the big event, right, of the fighting and stuff like that. So yeah, it's an interesting conversation to ask, like, well, what part did he have? Because everyone has their own opinion about that, but the archive tells us that he was a latecomer, and it just so happens that because of that, he was elected by his brother, who was also part of the nine, to become the president, the face of the political party.
And when you say the nine, can you explain who that is?
Yeah, let me. Dora Maria Téllez is one of the nine. So the nine are the leaders that essentially made the political movement and led the revolution. So I'm going to take a pause. I'm going to look up their names because it's been a minute, but I know for a fact Dora Maria Téllez was there. So let me take a look real quick. Okay, we're back. So when I mentioned the nine, it refers to the nine leaders of the Sandinista Revolution during the 1980s. And so first we have, right, Daniel Ortega, Carlos Fonseca Amador, which was a founding member, and essentially the key, and he was key to the intellectual foundation of what we know as the FSLN now. Humberto Ortega, which is Daniel Ortega's brother, who just passed away, I believe, about a year ago. He was the significant military leader within the FSLN. So he's the one that actually was out there in the front lines, right? Joaquin Cuadra, another military leader. Tomas Borges, who is now who has been one of the biggest anti-Ortega Murillo voice that exists currently. And then Pastora, also known as El Commander Cero, also another prominent leader. And then Hugo Spadafora, sorry, third last, Spadafora, another founding member, Sergio Ramirez, and Victor Jerez. And I would include, like I mentioned, Dora Maria Téllez, who it was a one of the most influential voices of the 1980s and 1990s, a queer military leader of the time, and also now. One of the strongest, in addition to Tomas Borges, one of the strongest voices that criticizes and pushes back against the Ortega Murillo regime.
I was asking about the nine because I'm curious about how Ortega seems to have utilized the political revolution to help his own ascendancy into power, and then is doing things that so many in Nicaragua disagree with. So I was just wondering if any of the other people who are credited with creating the FSLN have anything to say about his politics. And you mentioned that there's one big critic. Yeah, just was wondering if there's any, dissension amongst people who are like, you're not adequately representing what the FSLN was supposed to be.
Yeah, of course. In 2023, there was 222 political prisoners that were ousted of Nicaragua into the U.S. This plane, just I'm going to say it this way, but just magically shows up at in Washington, D.C. in 2023 with 222 political prisoners, and among them, the majority were political FSLN leaders, influential leaders of the FSLN. When the 2018, and even before that, you know, there's always been dissension, but Daniel Ortega has had, he's had people, como se dice, in his pocket to push back against, right, any type of dissension. And typically the dissension has happened singularly. You don't, we haven't seen like where the nine get together and just push back against, right? Some of these nine have also passed away in the last few years, but there has never been a reunion of the nine or the those that are left behind to do a more collective oppositional approach to Daniel Ortega. But once 2018, the moment of 2018 happens, you see this percolating a lot more. You see all of these voices coming up to the point that then we see where Daniel Ortega starts acting more as an authoritarian ruler than an actual democratic ruler when he starts imprisoning these dissenters, right? And this includes journalists as well. This includes student activists, professors of the universities, and essentially throwing them into jail and calling them, you know, political prisoners. And then out of just the blue, in 2023, he sends 222 of them to the U.S. And it was also very stark, and it was shocking to experience that, to see that happening on the news, where, you know, in Washington, D.C., they're coming off the plane and they're asked, like, how did you get here? Did you even know that you were being exiled or extradited to the U.S.? And the majority of them said, no, we didn't know anything. We were just woken up and told to get ready. We were taken to a plane, not told anything until we arrived. So from the moment we hit ground is when we knew that we were in another country. And some of these folks don't have any families here in the U.S., and so it was a very jarring thing to see, and also jarring in the fact that it tells you how much power Daniel Ortega has, and also leaves me with some. And I would love to have a conversation with someone who might know more about this. And I've tried to do some research on this and haven't gotten a lot of information. But how did that plane get from Nicaragua to the U.S. knowing, you know, post 9/11, the post 9/11 world we live in, you know, planes just can't go from one country to the next without any prior, you know, working, right? So that's always left, you know, a big question mark in my mind of like, what happened there? Were there conversations that the U.S. had with Nicaragua to have these political prisoners let go in the U.S.? Because we don't know yet. And Daniel Ortega takes it on as like, no, this is me.
Right.
Giving you an example of my power to expel anyone who opposes me. Right. And so that's where kind of that narrative has died and that's where it stayed. But I think there's more to it. And so if anyone would like to have a conversation about that or has any literature about that, I'd be open to hearing more about that.
So I wanted to end by having you answer sort of the main questions of your article, which are, in what ways do women and queer Black Nicaraguans push against modes of dehumanization and dispossession? How do they verbalize, perform, and imagine alternative modes of life? How do they participate in collective forms of care in their attempts to mitigate violence?
Yes. Specifically in this article, I focus on an event, A few days prior to me arriving to Costa Rica, I was notified by one of my interlocutors that there were a colectiva de feministas, Nicaraguan feminists, were putting on an event. And this event was specifically focused on the memories of survival from the April 2018 uprising. And so it was an experience. It was an event that wanted to really hone in on the resistance, the strength, and also the tenderness of this moment, right? It was a space that allowed for whoever was there to share informally or formally their experience. But for the event specifically, they organized it around a poetry event. And so what they did is they curated, they put out a call to the exiled community of Nicaraguenses to write poetry about that experience. And then on the other end, they had already been working on an oral history book about the narratives and experiences of those that participated. And what that moment looked like for them, living that resistance and also living against that repression. And so we have then an event that takes two angles, one, the poetry reading, and the other one, sharing this oral history book that they've been working together to create for the past year and a half. So I went, this event happens in 2023. And so a year prior to that was when they started producing the oral history book. And the oral history book and the poetry are not just from Nicaraguans exiled in Costa Rica, but folks who are actually still, some of them are even still in Nicaragua, who clandestinely shared their poetry and their experiences for a sense of survival, understanding that they're not alone, even if they're in Nicaragua or say in Spain or in the US as exiles, fighting political oppression. This moment, this event allowed them to come together to share their experience and feel a sense of collective belonging and a sense of collective survival. And what that did at the end of the night, which was what I experienced, is that it gave them more courage and more strength to continue surviving against this moment of exile. And with those conversations at the end, kind of reflecting on the poetry and the oral history book that was given, was like, wow, look at everything that we've gone through. Look at how much we continue to resist as women, as mothers, as queer and the trans identifying people. We got to keep going. There's no way that our lives are going to freeze because of the fact that we are in foreign land. And so that really was what essentially created the foundation, right? In understanding that even moments of care, events that produce care, allow for moments of feeling of continuation, of the ability to feel strength to continue the fight against repression. And so the collective of radical feminists that put this together essentially made it a point to say that they were doing this, one, right, for a sense of belonging, two, to understand that their voices and their experiences should never be erased, because that is part of the repression that's happening in Nicaragua, where the government is actively finding strategies to erase this experience, erase this moment. And what these experiences or what these events do is essentially push back, right, and contest that ideology and that repression that the country is essentially doing to them. And so what we see is then through the poetry is not just the forms of resistance, but also the challenges that they face, right? But even in the challenges that they face, they still are able to find community, find belonging in amidst this violence. And through that action, then we can understand how they're producing alternative modes of resistance and alternative modes of existence. And so the last thing I'll say is that one of the things that they want us to remember is that memory and history are important. Mm-hmm. And that we need to consider how we can find and understand these alternative voices to the meta-hegemonic history that's being produced. Because if we don't, then we allow, right, for these meta-histories to dictate how we remember pivotal moments like this one. And so they do that through their poetry and through their oral history narrative book that they call Portando Memorias. So that's kind of how I understood the experience, and it gave me the sense of being able to answer those questions, right? That history is important.
Yes, thank you so much for sharing that. And one of the things I took away from your article was the ways in which these women are engaging in radical survival. And I appreciate how you're documenting that radical survival, because that's why memory is so important, because these voices are not captured in dominant archives. And so it's through memory and storytelling and passing on that memory that we're able to preserve these perspectives that would otherwise just vanish.
Right. Yeah.
So Thelma, the last question that I ask folks when I interview them is, what has been inspiring you lately?
What has been inspiring me lately? I know we talked about this at the beginning, but two things have been inspiring me. One was the Dartmouth conference that lives so deeply within me. Mm. And two, right, it's May 6th, which means that the anniversary of April 18th just passed. So the 7th anniversary of April 18th. And what inspired me is to see how 7 years later, this is still very much a prominent, urgent, and necessary project of a human rights project, right? A social justice project that continues to fight against a government that continues to try to erase their experience. Every day, the government comes up with new ideas on how to dissuade and crack down on dissent. But every day, there are multiple myriad voices that exist that counteract it. And with this last anniversary, it reminded me of the fact that this continues. This is not a project that just ends because of the fact that it happened 7 years ago. It's a continuous fight that we want to see through until Nicaragua is in fact blue and white again. Mm. Un Nicaragua libre. Mm.
Well, Thelma, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. This was super needed. I learned so much about Nicaraguan history myself, and it's definitely something that I'm interested in bringing more to the podcast. I do have to admit that my Salvadoran background sometimes makes it so that Salvadoran history is at the forefront, but I want to change that. And thank you so much for helping me bring Nicaraguan history and perspectives to the podcast.
No, thank you so much. And I really love what you're doing. And whether it's Salvadorian Just Salvadorian, I think it's still an amazing thing that you're doing, because it, like I said, these are histories and stories that are necessary and urgent and important. So thank you. Thank you for your invitation.
Awesome. Bye, Kachimbonas.